This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Climate change is expected to cost the world trillions of dollars in economic damage, aside from the irreparable environmental impact some communities are facing even now. Considering the urgency, are our world leaders doing enough in the fight against climate change? Well, on the 30th of November, COP21, also known as the 2015 Paris Climate Conference, will gather global stakeholders to what will be one of the largest climate conferences ever organized. Over the next four episodes, we will cover its importance, its challenges, and what needs to come next. In today's first episode of COP21, we give you the must-knows of climate change and the talks surrounding it. How did it all begin? The conference, the issue, the science. Most of us only really became familiar with climate change with Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, but it dates back a lot further. Dr. Matthew Ashfold, atmospheric scientist at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus, takes us a few steps back to the 19th century where the phenomena of climate change was discovered.
Towards the start of the century, one or two scientists were having ideas that particular gases found in Earth's atmosphere could be important for keeping Earth's surface warm enough for life to exist. So by about the middle of the 19th century, a scientist called John Tyndall was able to demonstrate that particular gases, for example, water vapor and carbon dioxide, are able to absorb heat, energy emitted by the Earth's surface. So these are gases that we now call greenhouse gases. And then towards the end of the 19th century, another pioneer scientist called Arrhenius did some calculations that suggested that indeed variations in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could lead to changes between glacial and interglacial periods in the past. And he also made predictions about what could happen in the future if we increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so he thought there would indeed be some warming if that happened.
This discovery, which proved that climate change did in fact exist and did in fact alter the conditions of our planet, prompted countries to take immediate action as they gathered together to discuss. Pierre Raran, expert in energy policy from France, gives us a glimpse on what the Rio Convention was all about.
Donc ensuite, très vite, il y a une négociation entre les pays qui va déboucher sur la conférence de Rio de 1992, le sommet de la Terre de Rio, qui prend des orientations de développement durable.
So negotiations then begin between the countries, and in 1992 the Rio Conference is held, which was the Earth Summit, and this concept of sustainable development emerges after the Broadband Report in 1987. And they negotiate along the lines of three different conventions. One is on climate change, one is on desertification, and one is on biodiversity. And then they draw up international treaties that they then sign.
International est signé par l'ensemble des pays sur la nécessité de lutter contre le changement climatique.
And so the Rio Convention is actually the first text, which is still valid today, and the basis for all future negotiations on the issue. It's a political text that details the responsibilities that are held by industrialized countries and developing countries, because we then saw that most of the greenhouse gases were coming from industrialized countries who were using fossil fuels, coal, gas, etc.
Puisque historiquement, je dirais l'essentiel de la déforestation, des émissions de gaz à effet de serre et de la responsabilité des pays industrialisés qui, depuis le milieu du 19e siècle, utilisent massivement le charbon et les combustibles fossiles, pétrole, charbon, pétrole et gaz.
The Rio Convention acted as an important step for the battle against climate change. The Conference of Parties, set up to review the convention, has been taking place for over 20 years now, with a range of successes and failures. It is important to know why this is occurring and what their main objective seems to be. Hilary Chu from the Third World Network explains.
The Conference of Parties, we call it the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, was established following the Rio Convention in 1992. It is set up to address the issue of climate change. Then the parties will all come together at year-end, and they have a summit, and then they discuss how to implement, basically, the convention.
The Conference of Parties has been the catalyst for well-known climate change agreements such as the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, the Montreal Convention in 2005, and the Green Climate Fund in 2011. However, despite the Conference of Parties' yearly efforts to review the convention and fundamentally address climate change, we have not been seeing significant results in terms of reducing emissions and capping global warming. Every day, we still push the limits of our Earth, almost ignorant of the consequences ahead. So how effective has the Conference of Parties been really?
As you can see, we are still struggling with this issue 20 years down the line. So I would say there's still a lot of work for the Conference of Parties to do. However, I think we also have to look at it in another way. If this process was not here, I really believe we'll be in a far worse off position. So I think this is an important process that brings everybody to the table to discuss this global critical, you know, humanitarian crisis, really. And to my mind, really, this kind of dialogue is the only way forward. Because what we are dealing with here is issues that are so entrenched in the way we look at things. You're looking at what people regard as a threat to lifestyles. You know, we're looking at paradigms where we think growth is, you know, continuous and limitless. So these are very, very fundamental issues that need to be addressed. And although we have been slow moving, I cannot think of any other process that we can use to address an issue like this.
This humanitarian issue, as Lavanya Rama Iyer, Head of Policy and Climate Change at WWF, put it, is more pressing than we think. So is the Conference of Parties enough? Recently, the International Planet for Climate Change, or IPCC, has warned that if we exceed more than 2 degrees of warming, our Earth should prepare itself for drastic changes. What do we mean by 2 degrees? And more importantly, what does it mean to exceed it?
First of all, we should say that the commonly used limit is 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's essentially the temperature of the 19th century. And it looks like today, in 2015, we're going to have the warmest year in our instrumental record of about 0.8 to 0.9 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial. So we're already getting towards halfway to this 2 degree limit. 2 degrees Celsius is not a magic threshold below which we'll have no problems and above which we suddenly have very serious problems. It is a kind of gradual scale, but I think it's useful to have a goal in terms of policy which is measurable. I think this is also plausibly achievable. In terms of moving beyond the 2 degree limit, I think one of the main points is we probably encounter more uncertainty. We move further away from the climate that our infrastructure and the natural worlds are adapted to into things that we know less about. An idea that's talked about quite a lot is climate tipping points. And these could become more common beyond 2 degrees of global warming. And these tipping points are where we move from gradual changes into something, a completely new climate regime. So people talk about irreversible melting of parts of the Greenland or the Antarctic ice sheets, or abrupt changes in ocean circulation patterns. And so I think once we go beyond 2 degrees of warming, we get more and more into the realm of uncertainty.
But as we enter this new realm of uncertainty, what more should we expect? Up next, we understand the objective, the consequences and the challenges of the Paris talks. BFM 89.9. Welcome back. In the first part of the show, we spoke a little about how the infamous battle against climate change started and the efforts being made by countries to address it. The consequences of exceeding a 2-degree rise are still unclear. And perhaps describing it as an uncertain realm doesn't quite explain it enough. Pierre Raran, an expert in energy policy and former president of the ADEME, explains some possibilities.
Les derniers rapports des scientifiques ont beaucoup approfondi la question agricole et la question de l'accès aux ressources en eau. Pour faire le constat que si la planète est plus chaude, la surface des océans va être plus chaude.
So, all of these scientific reports then moved on a little bit more to focus on the subject of agriculture and access to water. If we're looking at a climate that's hotter, then the surface of the ocean is also hotter, so therefore there's more evaporation, therefore there's more rain, which is more violent around the equator, and much stronger also at the two poles, north and south. Therefore, there's less water in the tropics, both on the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. And you can understand the situation that we would face if we went beyond those 2 degrees, because there would be a lot more violence. Imagine if populations were displaced because they simply have no access to water, no access to food.
Chassées de leurs terres parce que elles n'arrivent plus à avoir la production agricole suffisante.
And the consequences here in Malaysia? Dr. Matthew Ashfold tells us more.
So I think already there's good observational evidence for rising temperatures in Malaysia over the last decades. It's not clear that there have been any trends in rainfall patterns, but the type of thing that Malaysia could expect possibly in the future could be longer periods of droughts and possible stronger flooding episodes as well. And so I think what happened last year, 2014, could possibly be a good example of the type of thing Malaysia could expect. So, particularly in the peninsula of Malaysia, early 2014 was very dry. We had problems with water shortages. Then later in the year, towards the end of 2014, there was some really serious flooding in the north and the east of the peninsula. I don't want to say that these things were definitely caused by anthropogenic climate change, but these are the type of things that we predict could become more common in Malaysia in the future.
At current rates, the urgency to cut emissions is there. With an overarching aim to cap warming at 2 degrees and ensure a legally binding agreement, the ambitions and stakes are high for COP21. What is required to achieve this? Lavanya Rama Iyer outlines the importance of balancing responsibilities with capabilities.
There are many things in terms of interests of different countries. Developing countries still need some leeway or space to continue with their development agenda because they have pressing issues like poverty to deal with. So these are things that need to be balanced. And under the text of the Umbrella Convention itself, there are provisions which recognize the greater responsibility of countries that have advanced in the past. So these are principles that have to be entrenched in this agreement as well. It includes things like finance, how climate finance will flow towards countries that need it in order to maybe leapfrog into a more low-carbon pathway than what developed countries use to get to their developed stage. In terms of technology transfer, you need technology very urgently, otherwise you have a lock-in effect. For example, if you build a coal power plant today, you're not going to be able to decommission it tomorrow. It will be functioning for the next 20 to 30 years. So these are long-term planning things that need to be addressed quite urgently today. And also this idea of loss and damage. There are certain things that are inevitable, that losses will have to be borne. And how do you address that? How do you compensate people who are suffering because of this? So these are some of the components that have to be agreed by the entire, members of the UNFCCC to come up with a comprehensive agreement. So Paris is meant to come up with something meaningful. If not in delivering that very agreement, at least in paving the path towards it, sort of ensuring that
the discussions continue in order to meet these targets and ultimately limit temperature rise to the 2 degrees that science dictates.
In addition to the components outlined by Lavanya, methods of development is central to the negotiations that will happen in COP21 to ensure sustainable models of development in all countries, rich and poor. Coupled with the UN's new sustainable development goals, Pierre Garan claims it will all fit together perfectly.
Vous comprenez qu'on est là devant des sujets importants et je reviens.
So these very important issues are what's on the table at the Paris conference. It's not just about climate change. Actually, it's about methods of development, how countries develop, and it's about making sure that we have very high or as high as possible energy efficiency, that we give priority to emission-free energy, renewables, for instance, that our transport systems should be emission-free, whereas they are 95% based on use of oil today, that our farming systems should be completely revamped, that our housing that we build should avoid requirements for heating, or indeed cooling, and that all countries should be able to tailor-make their own development plans to include all of these priorities.
Pour dans certains pays éviter les besoins de chauffage, ou dans d'autres pays d'éviter l'utilisation excessive de la climatisation. Et donc tous les pays ont aujourd'hui à élaborer cette voie de développement pour eux-mêmes en fonction de leurs conditions nationales et de ce qu'ils peuvent avoir comme aide internationale. Et donc, cette négociation, vous le savez, arrive la même année.
In the same year as these negotiations will take place, the UN, as you know, will adopt in the last week of September the new sustainable development goals that take over from the Millennium Development Goals that were set in 2000. The target year for those goals was 2015. The target year for the new goals will be 2030. Colombia set out at one of the last conferences that all countries were required to adhere to these new universal commitments. And as you can imagine, all of this fits together. Actually, quite neatly, and works in the same direction.
Que tous les pays prennent des engagements universels de développement durable, et donc cette question de la stratégie de développement liée au climat, en fait, s'intègre dans cette réflexion commune, elle aussi, à l'ensemble des pays de la planète sur le développement durable, qui va être adoptée à l'Assemblée générale des Nations Unies de septembre.
However, the prospects of COP21 are still haunted by the collapse of COP15 in Copenhagen in 2009, where an attempt at an agreement resulted in a vague acknowledgement. The final negotiation text was only given to heads of states on the last day and with colliding interests. Copenhagen was a failure. Countries lost trust amongst each other and ignored the process amidst their strong desire for an outcome. Will things be different this year? Or will this strong desire for an agreement once again fuel another collapse? According to Lavanya Rama Iyer, countries have definitely learnt their lesson.
What I think countries have certainly learnt, and I see a more nuanced approach, I think, in moving towards Paris, where that rebuilding of trust seems to be taking place, and more cooperative measures are needed. It's very critical that trust is re-established, and this kind of usurping of, you know, general consensus in the favor of a few does not occur. And I think everybody has learned from what happened in Copenhagen, and I do not expect such a thing to happen again, especially not in Paris.
We stress on cooperation and trust, but are these elements really present in the Paris talks? With an unsteady track record, the commitment of the United States is still debated. The United States was a strong advocate for the Kyoto Protocol. However, when it came to committing, they refused the legally binding aspect of it and did not sign it. Will we see a repetition of this at COP21? How active will the global power be at pushing the limits of these talks?
The US, I mean, they have negotiated the Kyoto Protocol, but in the end, they did not sign. So there is also the concern that they may not sign this agreement, that they have been participating very actively and maneuvering and manipulating the process as well. The concerns of observer now is that we might get an agreement, to pander to what the U.S. wants. So the U.S. is trying to downgrade these global climate rules, actually. So they want to get a very minimal agreement so that they can present it to Congress and get it signed through the executive order, right? Obama wants to leave a legacy. He wants to show that U.S. can be a leader in climate change. But then that will mean that it is downgrading these climate rules and is weakening this international climate policy space. Most likely, if U.S. have their way, we're going to get a very, very weak agreement. And that is not good for climate, and that's not good for society, that's not good for developing countries especially.
The support from the developed countries like United States is key if we want to see something come out of COP21. Developing countries need to leap into a stage of development in ways never done before. Pierre Radan highlights the importance of cooperation in this process.
Vous comprenez bien que la question est particulièrement essentielle du côté des pays en développement. Les pays en développement les plus pauvres n'ont pas utilisé de combustibles fossiles, n'ont pas émis beaucoup de gaz à effet de serre. Et donc, ils n'ont pas réussi à entrer dans l'industrialisation comme les pays de la première génération de l'industrialisation.
So, actually, the key issue for developing countries is, even though they are the poorest countries, they have never used probably fossil fuel, they've never emitted greenhouse gases, they weren't in the first wave of industrialization as the EU was, as the North America was, as ex-USSR and Japan were. Neither were they in the second wave of generation of industrialization as China and India have been. Actually, now they are trying to develop, but we are saying that they cannot do this on the back of fossil fuels, coal, oil and gas. So we are saying this is simply not acceptable. So actually what these developing countries are saying is that they have to go from being underdeveloped or not developed to a state that's beyond development that we're seeing today. So therefore they need our help in capacity building, in technology, in financing, because they're having to skip that whole fossil fuel stage.
On doit faire cette voie-là, il faut que vous nous aidiez. Il faut que vous nous aidiez par de la technologie, par du renforcement des capacités, par des financements, pour qu'on puisse, je dirais, passer directement, par-dessus l'utilisation des combustibles fossiles, vers une nouvelle voie de développement. Et ça, on ne pourra pas le faire tout seul.
Change is about much more than just the environment. The COP21 talks are faced with a deeply entrenched political issue and a series of intertwined interests and consequences. Join us in the next episode as we cover one of the biggest challenges surrounding COP21, reaching a fair agreement for both developed and developing countries. This has been Earth Matters on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.